I got the call several weeks ago from one of my UU ministry colleagues here in the district. He asked me if I'd like to give my odyssey at our spring district ministers retreat a little later this spring in mid-April. An odyssey in this setting is where you spend an evening with your colleagues sharing some of your life journey, including, of course, your time in the ministry and what that's all been about, what it's been like, various paths it's taken, that kind of thing. Well, I was honored to be asked, but I did accept with a slight undercurrent of trepidation. This invitation reminded me of something I heard another colleague say at a pre-General Assembly gathering of Unitarian Universalist ministers some years ago. He had been asked to speak on the 50th anniversary of his ordination to the ministry. His opening line was, "I'm very honored to be here, but don't you usually ask an old guy to do this?" Well, actually, I am looking forward to it. I've enjoyed hearing what others have offered and sharing their journeys in these kinds of settings. I hope my own story has something that is worthwhile to contribute to all that as the 40th anniversary of my ordination comes up a little later this spring. One of the often recurring themes in these kinds of presentations is about turning points. That is, points where one realized that he or she needed a change of direction since the particular path they were on no longer felt like the right one for them. As I'll probably share in a few weeks, I reached such a point in my early 30s. By then, I had already gotten well beyond the very conservative and evangelical brand of Christianity in which I had been raised. But now I was beginning to discover some feelings of uneasiness even in the more liberalized form of Christianity which I had embraced as the foundation for my ministry at that time. And it was this uneasiness that eventually got me switched over to where I am now and where I have been for some time in the Unitarian Universalist ministry. Well, there were actually a lot of reasons for that uneasiness. I couldn't pin it down to any one thing. But esoteric as this may sound, one of those reasons was my realization that the Christian doctrine of the atonement no longer made any sense to me. And this was not just an intellectual debate I was having with myself. It had to do with things I had emotionally and spiritually internalized and lived by at earlier stages of my life, but which had no longer become meaningful to me or believable for me. Well, as I hope we go along this morning, the point I want to make this morning as we get a little further along is that atonement in and of itself is not a bad thing. We all need to do it from time to time. As we heard a little earlier, even dogs make atonements now and then. Atonement then has to do with how we recognize our misdeeds and make amendments for that. Last Sunday, I spoke on the subject of guilt and about the necessity of being able to distinguish between what I was calling reality-based guilt and irrational or useless guilt. That is to say, being able to separate out when we actually have caused harm or damage to another person or persons, or fallen short of our own ideals, and make amends for all of that, atoning, if you will. All of that on one side, and on the other, the need to distinguish all of that from needlessly feeling guilty because of negative messages we've given ourselves or heard from others. So this is really part two of that sermon. So while, as I say, I knew that human acts of atonement are often good and necessary things to do, it was the classical Christian doctrine of the atonement that began to grate on me. What am I talking about here anyway? It goes like this. The Orthodox Christian doctrine of atonement holds that the primary reason Jesus was on earth was to atone for the sins of humanity by way of his crucifixion and death. The historical reason for Jesus' execution most likely was a political one, having to do with the Romans fearing a popular uprising among the Jews whose land they controlled. They saw Jesus as a revolutionary figure who needed to be gotten rid of, and they did. But it was sometime after his death, as the first and second century church began to take shape, that a theological purpose was kind of attached to that death. And this theological purpose, primarily put forth by St. Paul, held that in dying the excruciating death that he did, Jesus was taking upon himself the sins and the very fallen nature of humanity itself. He was making a sacrifice, an act of atonement on our behalf, so we didn't have to do it, thereby making us fit and worthy for the good graces and the love of God. Furthermore, so this doctrine holds, there's nothing we can do on our own to make ourselves worthy or redeem ourselves. We were born, this is the doctrine of original sin, we were born into an inherently fallen state from which only God can deliver us by this act of atonement on the part of his Son, who was also God as well. And don't even try to figure that one out. By taking our own unworthiness upon himself and suffering and dying on our behalf, Jesus has rendered us worthy of the love of God, even if we don't really deserve it. Well, esoteric as all that may sound, I can tell you, it's pretty powerful stuff when applied in certain ways. If you're sitting in a pew at a revival meeting, as I did in my growing up days, if you're sitting out there in a pew and there's a revival going on and the evangelist is holding forth and you're carrying a weight of guilt and misgivings over stuff you know you did wrong, and then you hear that God will forgive you for all of it if you will just accept and believe what Jesus has already done for you, well, let me tell you, that'll get you off your feet and down to the altar in a hurry. Now, you're still expected to make amends for your misdeeds. When it comes to those you've wronged, you're not off the hook. But now you do so as one, thanks to Jesus' act of atonement, who has been reconciled to God. And this is why the cross is the central symbol of Christianity. It is to remind those of the faith of what Jesus did on their behalf. And on the Catholic side of the Christian family, the image of the suffering Jesus has kept on that cross. Again, as a reminder of what had to be done on your behalf. Well, one of a number of crises of faith I came to was when I began to think seriously about all this. Thinking seriously can be a dangerous thing. It can also be a liberating thing. My thinking, I was into my early adulthood now, went along these lines. Wait a minute here. Sure, perfect, I am not. Indeed, I know I have done things that have been harmful and hurtful to others. I know I have betrayed my own principles and values at times, and these are things which I rightly feel guilty about, for which I probably do need some forgiveness. Yeah, I'll agree as well. There is a fallen or a broken side to me and nature that on occasion, even when I know what is the right and good thing to do, I still don't do it. There are times when, yes, I can even relate to what St. Paul says when he wrote, "The good that I would, I cannot do." I'll acknowledge he was onto something there. But still, wait a minute. Granting all that I just said, none of that renders me guilty just for showing up in this world, which is what the doctrine of original sin essentially holds. And nothing in my misdeeds, as much as I regret them, and nothing in my essential nature, flawed as it is, I don't see anything there that would warrant a poor and terribly misunderstood soul to have to die a terrible death on my behalf some 2,000 years ago. At some point, I realized that those dots no longer connected for me, and my path took a turning point, which in time led me to this faith tradition of Unitarian Universalism and its ministry. Well, I offer all this, as I hope you know, not to denigrate the faith of any of those for whom those dots still do connect. I just reached a point where they're no longer connected for me, which is one of the reasons you got me here. And when I did find my way, though, into the UU neighborhood and home, I learned that one of the early architects of our faith went through a similar struggle of mind and spirit as I had done. And that was comforting to learn. Clear back in 1803 or thereabouts, and right pretty much in this part of the world, the Reverend Hosea Ballou wrote what is now regarded as one of the founding documents of American Universalism, which evolved into today's Unitarian Universalism. The title of Reverend Ballou's document was, and is, A Treatise on the Atonement. Ballou was originally a New Hampshire Baptist country preacher. He probably preached some, he preached somewhere in these parts a couple centuries ago. He was largely self-educated. His formal education only went to the third grade. And he switched his affiliation from Baptist to Universalist just as Universalism was getting a toehold on this country. He may well have been mulling over some of the same thoughts I had and just shared about 170 years or so before I had them. Well, okay, I'm going to throw in a little sidebar here. Over the past several weeks, an evangelical preacher named Rob Bell has been getting a good bit of airtime on the major cable networks and some ink time in some of our major newspapers, including last Friday's Boston Globe, for saying there's no hell and that the love of God will eventually save everyone from damnation. He's put all this into a little book he's got out titled Love Wins, and he seems to be having a pretty successful book tour going. As some of you may guess, he is incurring the wrath of many of his fellow evangelicals. But here's my take on the Reverend Bell. He's getting his Andy Warholian 15 minutes of fame by saying much of the same things our American Universalist forebears were saying over two centuries ago. Which makes me wonder if somewhere out in the great beyond, maybe Hosea Ballou and John Murray and other architects of early Universalism are looking down on all this, trying to figure out if there's some way they can get back to Earth just long enough to sue this Rob Bell guy for violating their intellectual property rights. But I digress. The Cliff Notes version of Reverend Ballou's essay goes something like this. Jesus' mission on Earth was, in fact, to deliver or save us from our more fallen or shadow selves, but not through an act of atonement by way of his death. Instead, it is the example of his life and the content of his teachings that can call and guide us from our sometimes broken selves to more holistic, restored, and reconciled to God's state of living. Jesus lived to call us to our better selves rather than dying to save us from our fallen selves, so said the Reverend Ballou. It's when the choir did that song a little earlier, they deliberately tweaked one of the words in there. It says, I think the reference is how he died to save us all, and you guys changed it to how he lived to save us all just to keep faith with good old Hosea Ballou here. Well, it was this precept, not Ballou's, that served as the basis for Universalist Christianity throughout the 19th and into the early 20th centuries. And while Unitarianism and later Unitarian Universalism expanded well out beyond this liberal Christian base, it has still maintained the idea over the ages that there have been great teachers of humanity, great bearers of wisdom, who have also played the role in human history that Ballou saw Jesus playing. And so today, in our Unitarian Universalist Statement of Purposes and Principles, we cite as one of the sources of our faith tradition words and deeds of prophetic women and men which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. That's one of our sources. And this is really an expanded and a universalized statement of the role that Ballou ascribed to Jesus in his treatise on the atonement. Today, now, we honor the words and deeds of prophetic women and men, but we don't tie it to any one individual, Jesus or otherwise. But in offering the view of Jesus that he did, and dropping the part about him dying for the sins of humanity, Ballou helped pave the way for this later expanded version in our purposes and principles that we now have. Well, what about the idea, though, of atonement itself? The care one needs to exercise, as I've come to learn, in casting off an outworn doctrine, as I believe I did, is not to throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater. As already noted, the need for atonement, for making amends, for both seeking out and offering forgiveness, and for seeking to live a more reconciled and at peace with one's self life. These are all still very real human needs. And this is why I believe these are common themes in many of the world's religious traditions. To cite one example, the Jewish New Year observance, which takes place in the early fall, culminates with the holiday of Yom Kippur. And Yom Kippur means Day of Atonement. As a person in the Jewish faith approaches Yom Kippur, they're supposed to prepare for the observance by first settling all of their offenses and misdeeds of the previous year, both with God and their fellow human beings. With God or Yahweh, the settling up or the atonement is done by means of fasting at Yom Kippur and by observing certain rituals. But even before you get around to settling up with God, you're supposed to first settle any debt of wrongdoing you've incurred with any of your fellow human beings first. In other words, you make amends with your fellow human beings, you seek their forgiveness in whatever ways you can, and then Yahweh is ready to settle up with you and offer divine forgiveness. Well, as you've probably already figured out, my personal theology balks or pulls up short at the idea of a supreme being who can dispense divine forgiveness. But I still like the process here. I like the idea that you have to get right with your fellow human beings who may have wronged in any ways, so you can then be right with yourself, be right with life itself, be right with the universe, however you may wish to express it. We all need to do this kind of atoning from time, Jewish or not. And in this way of doing it, nobody has to die a horribly bloody death. To speak about guilt and atonement and forgiveness also calls, I feel, for me to offer just a few thoughts about the nature of apologies. Overdrawn or not, I put apologies into two categories. I try to keep it simple by calling them Category 1 and Category 2. A Category 1 apology is one that is offered primarily for the purpose of covering one's behind. You see them in the political arena quite often. A public figure, an office holder, or an aspirant for an office will make some kind of a gaffe or a slur or say something that belittles another person or group of persons. And these kinds of apologies often begin with the word if. Now, fair or not, whenever I hear an ostensible apology being offered that begins with the word if, my red flag goes flying right up. You know how, you've heard them. If my unfortunate choice of words brought offense to some, or if my well-intentioned actions caused pain for some, yeah, it goes like that. All this nifty little construct does is take the responsibility off the person supposedly offering the apology and actually places the onus of being offended or hurt on the very person or persons for whom the apology is supposedly being extended. I'll leave some wiggle room here. But most apologies that begin with an if, there is very little taking responsibility for one's actions. Well, then there's this category two apology, which is one that really does seek forgiveness, and one that is offered in the spirit of atoning for a wrong committed. A category two apology is one that is offered when we know, recalling some of what I said last Sunday, when we know that we have betrayed some of the very purposes and actions we are attempting to live by, or from the knowledge that we've done harm and hurt and brought a rupture to a relationship that we value. This is usually a personal relationship, or it could be a larger relationship we feel we have with some aspect of humanity, with life itself, or with that which we sense is greater than ourselves. And so category two apologies and atonements are ones then that are offered for the sake of restoring a relationship. Restoring a relationship with others, even with one's self. Well, I have one more twist on forgiveness before I finish up for today. There's also a kind of forgiveness that needs to be offered for the sake of the forgiver, even more so than for the forgivee, if it were, as it were. And the best example I ever heard, best example I can remember about this type of forgiveness goes clear back to the mid-1980s. It involves a priest named Father Lawrence Jenko, J-E-N-C-O. Father Janko was working for Catholic Relief Services in Beirut at that terribly troubled time when a number of hostages were being taken. He was captured along with Terry Anderson and held hostage for 564 days by one of the more radical Shiite extremist groups who were operating there at that time. After his release, he was interviewed. He spoke about why, even though he could never forget some of the inhumane ways he had been treated, he talked about why he had to forgive his captors. After noting some of the ongoing effects of the physical pain that was brought upon him, he went on to say, "There are all kinds of pain we enter into in our lives, but I don't want to lug my own pain on so that it becomes the focal point of my history." Think on that line for just a moment. I don't want to lug my pain on so that it becomes the focal point of my history. Father Janko was saying that he came to a point after his release, and after, I would imagine, probably having worked through a good deal of anger, if not hatred, towards his captors, he reached a point where he had to forgive them as a way of ridding himself of the psychic pain he was carrying from his days in captivity. He knew his physical maladies would be with him for the rest of his life. He died of cancer about 10 years after he was released. But he also realized that he could not carry around the burden of anger for what had been done to him for 564 days for the rest of his life. He could not allow his life to be defined by that anger. Now, whether his one-time captors ever felt the need for his kind of forgiveness, whether they ever cared to accept it or not, that was really not the primary issue in this case. Father Janko was doing what he needed to do in order to live out a reasonably peaceful life for the remainder of the life that he had. So I'll close with this. Religious communities, whatever their orientation, however liberal or conservative they may be, are also human communities. As such, they contain within them the best that is in men and women and children, as well as our human foibles and our shortcomings and our failings. And these are the kinds of lives that we bring to a community like this one, seeking greater wholeness, seeking greater levels of relationship, and sometimes seeking the forgiveness and the reconciliation we need to get to those levels. We live our lives by coming into and then occasionally falling out of right relationships with ourselves, with others, with life, with that which transcends our lives. We live our lives by coming into and then having to be recalled back into the circle of life and love again. So let us each do our best to keep that circle whole in the life that we are continually creating here. With that in mind, let's sing together, "Break Not the Circle." It's number 323.